Welcome to a new episode of The Brand Called You. Today I have an old friend, someone who I have a lot of respect for, Sanjay Rishi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ashutosh. It's great to be here.
Sanjay is from St. Stephen's College. He's done his MBA from Faculty of Management Studies. One company person, 33 years with American Express, where he rose from manager to president of South Asia to member of the Amex Global Management Team. He's worked in India, London, and New York. Sanjay, really nice to have you here. So, you know, you worked for one company, you know, what I would call a cradle-to-grave kind of a career. Tell us some of the key highlights that you have been through in your career.
Well, a lot of people have asked me this question. So, technically, I haven't really worked for one company, although I've spent a long time with one company. I started my career after I finished my MBA with Asian Paints. And I worked there for a few years before I moved to American Express. So it was really my second company. But I've been with American Express for a very, very long time. And people have asked me, why did you stick around for so long? And I tell them that to me, it didn't really feel like one company because it gave me a range of experiences across business lines, across geographies, that made it feel like I was working for multiple companies. And I think the learning for me in this was that if you're inclined to explore the world, and I firmly believe in the adage that life is an adventure, David. If you're willing to explore the world, then joining a global company like Amex gives you multiple opportunities. And if you're willing to learn and try new things, then Amex gives that too. So I started life working in the card business, actually selling cards in Mumbai, then in Delhi, and then I moved to marketing. I was instrumental in launching the American Express Rupee card in India. And then I moved from there into helping American Express set up a global service center here in India. And people said, but you know, you're a business guy, and why have you moved into an ops role? And you know, to me, it didn't feel like an operations job. It felt like a wonderful opportunity to start something new for the company that would be able to add significant value. And I saw it as a startup operation. So I moved from, you know, fancy country manager job from a large office to literally a hole in the wall to a different legal entity because the company had to be registered as an export-oriented unit. And, you know, from multiple people reporting into me to one secretary, one computer, you know, one fax machine, one printer, but also one big vision to make something out of it. And, you know, that now has grown to more than 15,000 people. And it's pretty gratifying to see something that you were instrumental in starting up scale and become such a substantial part of the company's global infrastructure. So that then enabled me to move overseas and run not just the India piece, which I'd started, but also a number of other parts of our service operations based in the US. Which then in turn created an opportunity for me to run the American Express merchant services business in international. So I moved to London, which then opened an opportunity for me to run our corporate card business in the US. So, you know, one thing led to another.
Almost entrepreneurial.
Yeah, it felt like that to me. And, you know, also, I had this approach to work, which was that I will be working to the best of my ability, but also, you know, I'm not like super sort of committed to, you know, just one thing and one place alone. So in 2009, when I moved back from London, late 2008, I moved back from London to New York to run the corporate card business out of our global headquarters. My wife, who was a very successful executive in her own right in Pepsi, had given up a job and she'd become a trailing spouse when I was in London. And when I moved back to New York, she was very keen to start working again. You know, the kids had moved to college by that time. And, you know, so life wasn't exactly, you know, boredom would set in if she was going to stay at home. But the recession set at that time, late 2008, 2009. It was very hard for her to get, she got jobs, but not the ones that she enjoyed. And we made a decision which was quite difficult in the third quarter of 2009 that she would go back to India where she had considerable brand equity. And I said that I will follow you. She said, what are you going to do? I said, I'll figure something out. And She said, but you know, without a job? I said, koi na phir to naukri de dena. And then I went to my boss at that time and I said that, you know, I want to go because, you know, she supported me. I want to support her, go back to India. And he said that, you know, we've been thinking about a different model for emerging markets. And in our thought process is this notion that for fast growth markets like India, we need to consolidate all our business lines under one geography leader, as opposed to the traditional approach where these business lines are organized vertically. And would you like to run that? And I said, sure, why not? I mean, you know, that India is my roots, and you know, I just have to go back and get this thing started. So from there, this concept of One India was born. And so I walked into the meeting with my resignation letter, with an intent to part as friends, and I walked out with a brand new job, and I couldn't believe my luck.
Amazing.
So, but you know, had I been of a mindset where, you know, I kind of didn't have that, you know, kind of view that if things don't work out, I will leave and I'll work something out, then this would have probably never happened. Right?
So you launched American Express in India, you know, a long time back. How has this whole business changed and evolved over the last three decades?
Well, quite dramatically. I wouldn't say I launched American Express in India. It's
the rupee card.
Been in India since 1921, 22. Mm-hmm. It's been through you know, many avatars, and in its latest avatar, it's a mirror image of what it is globally, which is a lifestyle-oriented payments and financial services company. Yes, I was instrumental in the launch of the rupee card, mm-hmm. which was a defining moment for the company. You know, the business of payments has undergone massive transformation, but I would say 90% of this transformation has happened in the last 3 or 4 years in India. I'm talking about India. So if you track the history of the American Express card, or for that matter, most credit cards in the country, then from the time they were launched, and most of the launches happened in the late 80s and early 90s, and then it continued through the late 90s into the new millennia. It was kind of steady state. You know, growth was, you know, coming at a predictable rate of 12% or 15%. And then with a lot of forces coming into play, suddenly the, you know, government stepping in with progressive regulations to eliminate cash, demonetization, the growth of bandwidth, new technologies, access to financial services on the smartphone, that like created a massive inflection point in the market in India. And I would say that if you look at the payments business over the last 3 years, from 2016, late 2016 is when demonetization was announced today, it has more than doubled in size. And electronic payments in India were less than 5% of the total consumption expenditure that was happening. And today, it is more than double. So there's been phenomenal growth. And of course, as the market grows, as you know, the rising tide, you know, if the tide starts to rise, mm-hmm. all boats have to mm-hmm. get lifted with that. And I think American Express also enjoyed its share of the growth, as have the other players. Sure. So times are really good.
Sure. So, you know, again, American Express was always a very, very aspirational card.
Right.
I remember, I think I got my first green Amex card when I was 27 or 28 working for ITC.
I hope you're still a card member.
I am.
Excellent.
I am. And my card still says that member since 1991. But the thing is that over the years, you know, cards are there in everyone's wallet. And yet we find that in India, there's a big gap between card usage and cash.
Right.
What is happening and why is this taking so much time?
Well, there's been a traditional preference for cash in India. It's a cash-intensive economy. And just to give you a data point, even with this doubling of electronic payments, that 10% compares very poorly with the global average, where about 40 to 45% mm-hmm. of all payments are electronic. And there are many reasons for this. Mm-hmm. There's been a traditional preference for cash, yep. both from the user standpoint as well as from the merchant standpoint. The infrastructure to accept electronic payments was not available. There were security concerns. There were pricing concerns. So all that has been tackled through the forces of progressive regulations, the forces of technology and innovation. And it's beginning to change. Now, is it going to happen overnight that India moves from 10% to 40% electronic payments? Probably not. But are we on the right course and are we accelerating our speed? The answer, I think, is definitively yes. Look, I mean, the reality is that you can't buy drugs on cards. You can't buy guns on cards. Sure. And, you know, the government knows that there's a cost of handling cash. There's a social cost. There's an economic cost of printing cash, storing cash, transporting cash. And for all these reasons, it wants to introduce efficiencies in the way in which individuals and companies make payments and accept payments. And so I'm very convinced that this course,
the direction is
quite set. Yeah.
But again, you know, traditionally in India, there was Amex, Diners, Visa, MasterCard.
Right.
Today, everybody, whether it's an Amazon or an Uber or a Paytm or a PayPal, or everybody seems to have their own payment platform.
Right.
What is this going to do to cards?
Well, you know, it's not a winner-take-all market. When you look at a 10% you know, penetration, there's 90% of cash opportunities still, and people are innovating. And the more the innovation that happens, you know, the more people get transformed from cash users to electronic payment users. But, you know, fundamentally, if you look at a wallet that is offered on an e-commerce platform or a standalone wallet, like, say, MobiKwik is one such case, you know, they will continue to have to rely on some degree of banking activity, underlying banking activity that can load the wallet so that transactions can be performed using that wallet. They'll have to continue to rely on some degree of underwriting or risk management activity so that you can offer a loan to somebody, even if the person doesn't have enough funds in the wallet, but has an aspiration to buy a product that's more than the total value of the funds. That lending would have to be enabled by somebody who's got risk management expertise. So companies like American Express and some of the traditional banks actually have access to the funds and to customers who've got these deposits, and they've got access to the expertise that would enable some of these wallet providers to offer you know, lending services. So I think, you know, it will be a collaborative relationship, and these wallets are actually going to help the banks as well as the banks are going to help the wallets.
And of course, then there's RuPay, which is
yes.
being pushed by the Prime Minister himself.
Yeah.
But, you know, in spite of all the effort, you say that and I could be wrong in my narrative, but you said 10% of all payments are still on the card business.
Payments. But if you were to kind of unravel this a little bit more, if you look at the way in which people are sending money to each other now, there's a service that the government launched called UPI. And UPI now is enabled through a number of platforms like Paytm and MobiKwik and Veem. And you've got a number of platforms that enable you to send money to, you know, to anybody within the country using a mobile phone. Very easy. Now, if you include the remittance part, then this total payments market, which I estimated at about 10%, that translates to 170 million of a total private consumption expenditure, 1.7 billion, hence 10%. But if you add these remittances that are happening now electronically on the mobile phone, that total market blows from 170 billion to 420 or 430 billion this year. So there's a lot of... Now, you're saying that this is a P2P transfer, but it is also a P2 merchant transfer. You know, I mean, sometimes when you want to pay your dhobi wala, you want to pay the bread wala, you can just as easily use UPI and transfer money from your bank account using your mobile phone to the merchant's bank account. Now, it may appear as a peer-to-peer transaction, but it could be actually a payment transaction. So in that massive UPI volume, are also hidden some payments, although we don't count it like that. So I would say if you were to make an adjustment for that, let's say if you make 100%, everything is payments, then the market is, the penetration is about 20, 23, 24%, which is not a bad number.
Which is not bad. And yet when you look at readings and article, if you look at the Scandinavian countries where they're almost 100% cashless.
Right.
Do you ever see India reaching anywhere near those numbers?
Probably not. I think just given the challenges, the infrastructure challenges of the country, given the level of you know, sort of rural population versus urban population, there probably will continue to be a cash economy. In fact, in parts of India, we still have a barter economy, so it's going to take some time. But I think if you were to look at one of the interesting metrics I used to look at is that what has been India's contribution to growth, not percentage growth, but absolute value growth, dollar volume growth, in all the countries in which American Express operated. And although India was a small market in terms of absolute volume, it contributed disproportionately and was in the top three or the top five in terms of contribution or revenue growth. Okay. Percentage-wise, we were off the charts.
Sure.
But the real way to look at it is that dollar volume, if we've grown 100, how much is India's contribution? And if you slice that contribution by country, then India was in the top, you know, three or top five countries. And I think you can expand that thinking to global payments. And if you see the contribution that's being made by India and the growth of electronic payments, it is probably one of the strongest contributors today.
Interesting. So let me move to another part of the card business, which is loyalty points.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember, you know, in 89, when I first moved to Singapore, I just decided that I'm going to stay with one card, one airline, and one hotel. So I decided American Express, Hyatt, and Singapore Airlines. And till today, which is 30 years later, the points are so large that we have never ever paid for a vacation. Either the airline or the card or the hotel pays for everything.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts? Because I find a lot of young people in India just keep on getting more and more plastic cards and then earning in multiple places.
And so the problem with
the problem is that they don't seem to have enough points anywhere.
Well, you know, there are so points have different use cases depending on you know, what your lifestyle is. There are some people who will accumulate points because they're frequent travelers, so they will sign up with an airline program or a card program that has a co-brand product with an airline. There are people who, as part of that, they would also probably have a hotel loyalty program. And there are people for whom travel and stays doesn't mean much. They will accumulate points because they want to use them in retail. So you have products that do that. It's a retailer's own program, but, you know, with a credit card tagged along with it, a co-branded credit card, you can multiply those points. But the bottom line is that consumers expect value. They expect to be given a reason why they should continue to go back to the same merchant. Points are a great way of, you know, not just saying thank you, but a great way of giving value back to consumers. And, you know, they have demonstrated their ability to achieve a sustainable shift in terms of not just spending of people who've got points, but also to attract many new customers to the franchise of the people who are offering points.
Interesting.
So for Amex, that you know, that kind of pioneered this concept of points on cards, membership rewards, it has been a very powerful driver of all the value propositions.
Interesting. So one more question relating to Amex before I move to the next segment. You stayed with one company for 33 years, and young people today believe in jumping jobs every 2 or 3 years.
Right.
What are the advantages of staying with one company?
Well, you know, today there are so many choices available to young people. There's so much of information about how to make educated choices that I think times are very different. And industries are being disrupted, new opportunities are developing all the while. So I'm not taking a position on whether working with one company is a good thing and working with multiple companies is a bad thing or the other way around. All I'm saying is that that you need to be basically in a learning mindset. And even if you're in one job, make sure that job is imbuing in you the ability to become a better person tomorrow, more skilled and more effective than you were today. And if that is not doing it for you, then consider another alternative, because it's not like choices do not exist today. Multiple choices exist today. In our time, many, many years ago, we probably didn't have those choices. But that is not to say that I worked in American Express because there was no option.
Sure.
I did have options. I worked in American Express because I chose to work in American Express, you know, because I opened my mind to the possibilities of working with a global company and moving to different places and exploring the world. But today, I think everybody has to see their professional choices with the perspective of, is it adding value to me? Am I having fun? Am I learning something new? And if not, then find something that does that for you.
Interesting. So Sanjay, moving to another part of the thing, which is, you know, you and I are of a similar vintage, and you have really reinvented your whole life after you left American Express. There are a lot of people who are similar kind of profile like you and me, who are struggling, you know, because they turn 60 and then they don't know what to do with their life. And I often tell them that there are so many things to do.
Right.
You were just mentioning that you sit on several boards, you are an angel investor, you know, you're mentoring different kind of companies. What are your thoughts on people who are now giving up one part of their life and starting a new phase? Because I've written about this often that,
yes,
you know, your life after 60 will be as long as your working life.
Right.
And if you haven't planned for it,
yeah,
then you're going to be miserable.
Right.
So, thoughts?
Well, I think part of the problem here, I feel, is, and you've spoken about this eloquently, so I won't dwell on it much, is that we give this a word, we brand it retirement. You know, it's not really a retirement, yeah, it's a transition.
Correct.
And if you have lived your life well and if you saved enough, then you should be in a position during the time of retirement where you would probably feel that, you know, you're well taken care of financially, but you could always do better. But it's not, you know, sort of it's not, you know, sort of an economic compulsion that will drive you to do something else. I think it is really the fact that if you are healthy and if you see your life as an event with plenty of runway left, you know, because people would live up to 90, 100 now,
yeah,
then you have to rewire yourself to making a positive contribution to yourself, to your family, to society. And to be able to do that, the first most important thing is to keep your mind active.
Correct.
I am terrified of the day when I have nothing to do. And if my mind goes to waste, you know, it's not been occupied, then I actually can't sleep well at night. So for me, the thought of keeping my mind, because that drives every other system in the body, you know, it drives your relationships, it drives your willingness and ability to be physically active, it drives your sense of values. Everything starts with a healthy mind. So my first piece of advice to people who are in this retired phase, and you know, Hindu philosophy reinforces it,
correct,
is that do something to keep your mind active, because everything else will flow from there. If you let your mind become inactive, then everything will start to decline from there. And this does not necessarily mean you start becoming an angel investor looking for another job or whatever it is. Find out what is your real passion, because now you have an opportunity to do that, but keep your mind active. So I have a great friend, mutual friend of ours, who told me, gave me this piece of advice. He says, listen, there is no shame in saying that you're doing nothing at all.
Sure.
There's no shame in saying that you're doing nothing at all. But how you're occupying your time, you should have a meaningful response to that. Because if you're saying you're doing nothing at all in an occupational sense of that term, and you're also saying I'm doing nothing at all even outside, then there's a problem. So keep your mind active is the bottom line.
Wonderful. So that's an interesting segue into the next question, which is, you know, you said don't be an angel investor, but you are an angel investor. So quick question, what do you look for when you make an investment?
Yes, sir. It doesn't necessarily have to be angel investment, but you know, in my case, I kind of I like the idea. You know, obviously, my and so I got introduced to angel investing through Common Friend, and you know, I discovered that today's world is so different from the world I grew up in terms of technology enabling so many new ways of designing and delivering products and services.
Yeah.
In the financial services arena, in the healthcare arena, in the consumer product space, there's so much of disruption happening that I found it quite fascinating. Having grown up in payments, you know, it's gives you an entree into many different businesses that payments enable. So you learn a little bit about how corporate payments work, you learn a little bit about how consumer payments work. Within that, how does dining work, and how does retail work, and how does travel work? So I felt that I could contribute to a number of these businesses in terms of guiding them. So I'm not a technology person. I'm struggling with technology. I try and learn a little bit every day. But what got me into angel investing was just the fascinating amount of activity,
correct,
that was out there. And a belief that I could guide some of these entrepreneurs to success. So what I'm looking for really is I think the passion and the skill set of the individual. And I'm looking at this person not from the perspective of the role he is performing today, but in 5-10 years time, when he or she becomes successful, then would this person have the ability to surround himself or herself with good people and make an effective transition from being an entrepreneur founder into a leader of an organization that is being managed by professional managers? I'm looking for the smarts, and both intellectual as well as emotional smarts of the founder. Obviously, looking at the business model, correct, and what is the problem,
sure,
that it's trying to solve. And there's many cases where you know, it's a technology solution, but there's no real compelling, you know, pain point, mm-hmm, that is being solved for. I think that's very important in my book. I'm looking for a good value system. And I think this is my advice to young people as well, that, you know, don't get so excited with your idea that you start to compromise on you know, the rules that you're going to follow in pursuing the idea. So looking for a good value system. You know, so yeah, these are, I'm looking for the ability to present your idea in a very compelling way, as opposed to confusing people with lots of, you know, technical terms. You know, basic stuff, I think.
Okay. So Sanjay, moving into the last part of the program, which is just a few questions about you personally, because
yeah,
thousands of people watch this program and they all like to know something about our guest as an individual. So the first question is, when was the last time you did something for the first time?
Well, I mean, you know, when I left Amex around the back half of last year, mm-hmm, moving into investing in startups was something I did for the first time. I'd never done that before. Investing in a couple of funds. You know, these are small ticket, sure, investments, lest you think I'm this, like,
no,
guy who's like, you know,
like all of us,
right? did that for the first time. You know, so that was the last. But, you know, if I look at the turning points in my career, all those were first time events. Going and talking to my boss and saying I'm going to quit after, you know, 20 something years in the company was a first for me. I've never done that before.
Yeah.
You know, running a geography-based model was a first for the company. That was a first. So, you know, it's actually, when I look back, I have always been in first-time situations. Mm-hmm. And I guess that kind of intrinsically reflects my comfort with change and my comfort with ambiguity. I don't like predictable situations. If there's a little bit of grayness in it, then, and if I can help bring clarity, then that's what gives me true happiness.
So, you know, over 3 decades with American Express, transitioned beautifully into life after American Express, happy, settled. What is the secret?
Well, you know, I think you need to have a good support system around you. I'm fortunate to have a rock steady spouse, wonderful kids who are, now grown, and they've got, you know, their own lives. So I kind of feel grateful that I played a role in evolving them to the point that they are at. You know, it's not like all days are happy. There's some days when you have your frustrations.
Sure.
You know, you can't escape taxes, for instance. So you have to keep, so that's, you know, one of the things which I'm kind of struggling with is the administrative, you know, aspects of running your own gig. Because earlier your company used to take care of it, and your administrative assistant used to take care of it, and now you have to do all that yourself.
Absolutely.
But isn't it just the thought that, you know, I've got plenty of work that keeps me engaged, keeps me learning, and you know, I've got a good support system. I also am fortunate to, you know, live in a place where there's access to plenty of recreational activity. I play a little bit of golf. I thought I'd play a lot of golf after I left, but I'm not playing anywhere near as much as I thought I would, because I've got so many other things to do, fortunately, for me, from a, you know, professional point of view. And also, for me, it's very important to stay physically fit. And I actually do spend, on a weekly basis, I would say 3 or 4 days in a gym. And each session would be for about 3 or 4 hours, either running or lifting weight. And each session would be for about an hour. So that would be about 3 or 4 hours. So
you got me a little worried, run 3 to 4 hours a day.
No, 3 to 4 hours, okay, hours a day. Three in total.
Yeah, understand.
You know, and that's my other advice to people who are moving to the next chapter post a working profession, is to actually keep yourself physically fit. And, you know, because the body is remarkably resilient, it is remarkably elastic. And I think that just like the mind, and I think if you keep educating the mind, you keep learning new things, you keep getting smarter no matter your age. And it's the same thing with the body. You keep yourself physically fit. You know, you can get, if that's your goal, you can get a six pack even when you're 70 years old. There's no reason why you can't do it.
Absolutely. So Sanjay, my last question to you, and this is a question that I ask all my guests.
Yeah.
What is your biggest learning from your biggest failure?
So you're talking about failures and not regrets, because I have
regrets, failures, anything.
Well, you know, my biggest learning from my biggest failure is the importance of situational intelligence. And, you know, sometimes it's necessary to go fast, but sometimes it's also necessary to slow down. And I remember the situation when I moved into a job in New York. It was a very, very attractive opportunity. And I had, but it was a sizable business and a stable business that had been around for the longest time. And I came in bursting with these new ideas about, you know, how we can change this and cut that and grow this and disrupt that. And there was obviously a lot of resistance to that. And I felt I could push my way through because I was in a senior position. But I couldn't do that. And, you know, people, you know, then sort of started to push back. And I realized then the importance of getting people first to buy, you know, to your ideas before you actually start to implement them. And also that what you think is a good idea may actually be a lemon, because you haven't taken into account a perspective that can only be communicated to you through years and years of experience that those people who've been in the business have accumulated. And so my learning from that was that, you know, there's a song that says, you know, keep your friends close, but your enemies closer. Always surround yourself with people and listen particularly hard to those who've got a contrarian point of view. Because once you can get through the personal, emotional aspects of it, you will find value in that. And when I started to listen to people, I found out that they weren't blocking my ideas because they wanted to give this new guy a hard time. They had some genuine, you know, issues, some genuine concerns. And the moment I recognized that and I thanked them for it, we started to move a confrontational, you know, sort of relationship into a collaborative relationship where we jointly agreed to start working on those obstacles and to test and try, you know, a few things before we actually implemented those big ideas I had. And guess what? The final product was very different from what I had originally envisaged.
Sanjay, thank you very much. I think you've been really, really frank, honest, and that all the people who listen to our show would really love everything you've said. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for The Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.